When you're reaching for something on your spice rack to add a little flavor to a dish, the dramatic role spices have played in the development of Western civilization is probably the furthest thing from your mind. But in ancient and medieval times, they were rare and precious products used for medicine, perfume, incense, as well as flavorings. On this edition of Please Explain, we're going to talk about spices, where they come from, how to cook with them, and how it is that our bodies and brains can tell the difference between, for example, spices that are sweet, hot, or very hot. And joining us now is Dr. John E. Hayes, assistant professor of food science at Penn State University. He studies the psychophysics of taste and flavor perception. Also, Michael Crondall, who's a chef, teacher, and the author of several books about food and cooking, including Around the American Table and The Taste of Conquest, The Rise and Fall of Three Great Cities of Spice. It's published by Ballantyne. Welcome to our show.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Michael, to begin at the beginning, how do we define spice? What's the difference between a spice and an herb, for example?
Well, it seems like English is one of the few languages that actually makes that distinction. But in English, a spice is any aromatic part of a plant except for the leaves. Everything, the leaves are herbs, the roots, the berries, everything else is a spice, quote unquote.
So peppers can be both seeds and vegetables, depending on whether we're talking about the original peppers that came from Asia and then the ones that were called peppers that were found in the Americas.
I think that may be one of the very, very few vegetables that is also called a spice. Yeah, ginger maybe, because when you have really, really fresh ginger and you slice it up, it's almost served like a vegetable as well. But I can't think of another one like that.
Can you give us a sense of the history of the human use of spices? Is this something that goes back to the earliest times when humans first started walking around?
I imagine. My theory about this, and there's absolutely no way of proving this, but my theory is that the first use was probably medicinal, that people were wandering around and saw birds or other animals perhaps eating these things. They picked them up and they did something to them, so that they ate nutmeg and they started getting hallucinations. They ate chili peppers and they felt this burn, and maybe they started using them in medicine.
And why have they played such an important role in the history of the world, going back fairly early up to the time of the Columbian Exchange?
I think partially the medicinal aspect, so that people in one part of the world decided that they were good for you. So probably, for example, in India, in Ayurvedic medicine, you find spices used, 3,000 years ago. And then that idea penetrated to the Middle East, eventually penetrated to Europe. But the other thing about spices is that spices, particularly certain ones like pepper and nutmeg, are light. They're free. When you pick them off the vines or pick them off the tree at one end, you can transport them. They don't spoil. By the time they get to the other part of the world, by the time they get to, the Middle East or Europe, you can jack up the price 10, 100, 1,000 times and make a killing.
And we were told in high school that they also covered up the rancid taste of medieval foods.
Wrong. Wrong. I blame the French for that. The French at one point decided that they didn't like anything foreign in their food. And so they stopped using spices around the 17th century or so. And later on, French historians would tell you, oh my God, how could they have used so much spice? Little realizing that using spice is normal in many cuisines. In Moroccan cooking, they use lots of spices. In Indian cooking, they probably use 10 times as much spice as any medieval European ever did. So people just like the taste of spice in the Middle Ages. Forget the whole covering up the flavor of rotten meat.
John, we think of being able to taste spices, but what we mean by taste is different than what a scientist means, isn't it? Can you explain that for us? What's the difference between flavor and taste?
So when at Thanksgiving, when we say to our mom, that was a really fantastic turkey, I love the way it tastes, in that colloquial sense, we're really talking about what a scientist would refer to as flavor, and that's in the brain. We integrate a lot of different signals together to form that perception. So we get what's called true taste. That's the sweet, sour, salty, bitter, and savory that you learned about probably in health class at some point or biology class. But there's also the role of smell. And so that's very key. And we all know that anecdotally, that when you have a cold, things, quote unquote, don't taste right. And then there's input from a third system that we could say is the touch system or the somatosensory system. And that includes not only like the creaminess of fats and the astringency of teas and wine, but also it includes temperature sensations. So you have something like peppermint or spearmint, which causes a bit of cooling, or you have chili peppers or black pepper or ginger that cause burning sensations.
Now, we did a taste test on the show some years back in which we put nose clips on and then put all sorts of different jelly beans, I guess, in our mouths and couldn't taste them until we took the nose clips off, and we were really stunned by that. But I understand that that's not always the case, I can do a different kind of a test with some cinnamon that is in front of me, where I'll have two different experiences if I'm holding my nose or if I'm not holding my nose. Can you explain that? And should I be doing this? Should I be putting the cinnamon on my tongue?
Well, the demonstration is really the most powerful when a person doesn't know what's going to happen. So
I've been warned.
You've been warned, so you know what's going to happen. So if you want, I can just talk you through what
I'm going to do it anyway. What the heck? Okay. I hold my nose and put it on my tongue.
So you want to hold your nose and close your eyes so you don't know what you're getting. Of course, you do in this case. And put that cinnamon in your mouth. And then I want you to describe the sensations that you get from that cinnamon.
Well, baby, this is weak cinnamon. I'm talking about holding my nose. But it just tastes like bark more than anything
right.
else.
If you use really fresh ground cinnamon, what you'll get, I find, is you get this intense, chalky, really unpleasant sensation. And you get a decent amount of burn to it. And then now go ahead and unpinch your nose and exhale through your nose.
It's cinnamon. I'm ready to put on my French toast.
Exactly. And so what's going on there is we've knocked out the smell component. And so our brain doesn't know what this stuff is on our tongue. And so it's really kind of unpleasant. But then all of a sudden, once you add that input that the brain is used to getting, I find that there's this great affective shift. So it goes from being this really unpleasant thing to all of a sudden, oh, cinnamon, I like this.
My guests are John E. Hayes, Assistant Professor of Food Science at Penn State University, and Michael Crondall, chef, teacher, and author of several books about food and cooking. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. Please explain. We're talking about spices, and in a little while we will be taking your calls at 212-433-9692. That's 212-433-WNYC, or you can leave a comment on our show page at WNYC.org. Michael, is it true that the cinnamon that most of us use isn't really cinnamon at all?
Well, what I should say is that Leonard just had two sticks in his mouth. If you could see him, he had one stick of what really looks like hard bark in his mouth, and then this crumbly stick in his mouth. And in fact, the first stick, the hard bark, the stuff that we're all mixing into our cider and so on, that is not really cinnamon. That's something called cassia, which
this
is a close relative.
This big thing that looks like a tree?
The little hunks of bark that you had in your hand, that is actually cassia.
Mm-hmm.
The other thing, the crumbly big piece of tree, is actually real cinnamon, which is, you can identify it by the fact that it's kind of crumbly and falls apart in your hands. And this is real cinnamon from Ceylon. And if you taste the difference, there is a distinction. Most of what we get in this country is really cassia. Cinnamon, which Europeans tend to prefer, which Latin Americans tend to prefer, is sweeter, it's more aromatic, but it has less of that burn that John describes. And in fact, I have a question for John here. What causes that burn in cinnamon?
So there's a compound in cinnamon very cleverly known as cinnamaldehyde. Gotta love the way chemists name things.
Cinnamaldehyde.
Cinnamaldehyde.
Sounds like preserving an old movie.
Right, exactly. And so cinnamaldehyde actually binds to this receptor that we have on the tongue. And that's a really interesting story evolutionarily because it's actually a heat pain sensor. It's a molecular thermometer that sits on our tongue and other surfaces of the body. And once you get it up to about 42 degrees Celsius, so that's about 5 degrees more than body temperature, it activates and it sends a signal to the brain that says, ow, hot, stop, cut it out. But what happens is, with evolution, plants have figured out a way to hijack this system. So they produce chemicals that go and bind to that thermometer and lower the temperature at which it activates. So when we eat chili peppers, there's a compound called capsaicin. When we eat black pepper, there's a compound called piperine. When we eat ginger, there's a compound called zingerone. So when you put all of those into the mouth or other mucosal surfaces, if those of us that have accidentally chopped up chilies and then touched other body parts, discover is that you get that burning sensation.
Now, talking on an evolutionary level, why would we want to eat hot things like those, the really hot chili peppers? And people do eat them all over the world, don't they? They love hot things.
That's a fascinating question, and that's actually why I went to graduate school in the first place 10 years ago, was to study that very question.
Because they don't add food value, do they?
No, not really. So there's a lot of theories that float around there. There's one, somebody noticed that there's this wonderful latitude correlation to spiciness, and so a theory has been advanced by some evolutionary biologists at Cornell that there might be some sort of antimicrobial properties. But as Michael just told us, the idea that it's really for rancidity probably isn't true. The theories that I really like are those from Paul Rosin at Penn has done some really wonderful work. He's showed that he calls this benign thrill-seeking or benign masochism or constrained thrill-seeking. Essentially, his idea is that it's like riding a roller coaster in your mouth, that you know you're safe, but your body is getting this rush of this danger signal. And so that's one argument. The other argument that I'm kind of fond of is that if you have a very starch-based diet, you're not very palatable, eating really spicy food is going to increase your salivary flow. And all of a sudden, so when you're eating sort of that gritty, mealy tortilla, and then you go and you add more saliva to it based on the fact that you've made it very spicy with chilies, I think it becomes a lot more palatable.
I've heard another theory, and that is that in hot climates, people are less likely to feel like they want to eat. And if you eat something like a pickle or something hot and spicy, that gets your digestive juices going, and then you are more likely to want to eat.
That's really fascinating, because that actually disagrees with what I know about this effect. The third theory that I kind of like is this idea that you actually fill up faster. You get a satiety signal sooner. We know that both in humans, or we absolutely know that in animals, and newer evidence in humans suggests that if you give people spicy food, they actually eat less and take in less calories. So if you think maybe evolutionarily when food was more scarce, to get full, maybe we were adding spicy things. But well, you're absolutely right. It could be, I mean, these could be in opposition and occurring simultaneously. There could be this appetizer effect, too, that if you're not hungry, you know, you get your interest piqued by a little variety.
Now, Michael, you have recommended that we try some chili peppers, and I have a bunch in front of me. Should I do this to myself?
Well, your producer brought a whole bunch of chili peppers, and I have to say that I pulled out the really, really hot ones. I pulled them aside because I didn't really want you to choke on air.
Gave me a container of hot paprika.
For example, I gave you a closed container of hot paprika because we're used to paprika being a mild spice, right? But there is such a thing as hot paprika. Originally, all paprika was hot. Then they developed a milder variety. Hot paprika is as hot as cayenne pepper. So if you make a goulash with hot paprika, you will definitely want to move to a hotter climate.
And your eyes tear.
Your eyes tear.
And you sweat forms, beads along your hairline?
Well, this is another theory, incidentally, why people like hot food in hot climates is that it cools you off, which doesn't explain the Koreans, but that's another issue. So anyways, what I've brought, what you have in front of you is, I think, in order of where chilies came from, some ancho chili pepper, because chilies all come originally from the New World. So this is an American chili. I think I have some smoked pimenton, which is a Spanish chili, because it seems like chilies first went from the New World, then to Spain. Then I have some Aleppo pepper, which is from the Middle East, and it seems like the chilies went from Spain to the Middle East, possibly carried by Jews, which sort of makes sense chronologically. And then finally, you have some Indian chili pepper, and of course, we associate India with chili peppers.
Now, John, as I understand it, chilies do adapt to each different environment and become something different. You grow the chilies from the Americas are very different when you grow them in Turkey or when you grow them in Thailand.
Well, I have to say, first, I'm not a botanist, but absolutely, I think we can learn something from, we can borrow a concept from wine of the idea of terroir, that it's not just the plant. I mean, in wine, we clearly know that a Syrah grown in France and a Shiraz in Australia are almost completely different wines, even though they're the same grape. So I think that we would expect to see the same thing with chilies, that it depends on the climate and even probably the microclimate in which they're grown.
But the other thing about chilies is that chilies are notoriously promiscuous. You put two chili plants in one field and they will cross-pollinate and a third chili variety will come about. So there are hundreds, if not thousands, of varieties. And I've spoken to botanists about this, and they can't even sometimes distinguish between them.
And Mexicans tell me that two chilies from the same plant will have different heat, which strikes me as odd.
It has to do with this cross-pollination. You know, one bee lands on one and flower and another bee lands on another flower.
We have to take a little break. When we come back, we'll be taking calls from our listeners about spices. My guests are Michael Crundell, who is the author of a number of books, including Around the American Table and The Taste of Conquest, The Rise and Fall of Three Great Cities of Spice, published by Ballantyne. We may even get to those three great cities. Dr. John E. Hayes, assistant professor of food science at Penn State University, who studies the psychophysics of taste and flavor perception. Our number here is 212-433-9692. You can leave a comment on our show page at wnyc.org. We're back with Please Explain, and my guest, Dr. John E. Hayes, assistant professor of food science at Penn State University, who studies the psychophysics of taste and flavor perception. Psychophysics, is that a word that was just recently made up?
No, actually, the term's about 150 years old. It's the branch of experimental psychology that deals with quantifying the intensity of sensations as they relate to physical stimuli in the environment.
Also with us is Michael Crundell, who's a chef, teacher, and the author of The Taste of Conquest, The Rise and Fall of Three Great Cities of Spice, which is published by Ballantyne. And our number here is 212-433-9692. That's 212-433-WNYC. A listener wants to know, is it true that spicy foods from south of the border were originally spiced as a form of preservative?
No. Chili.
That's another one of those.
One of those things, yeah. There are certain spices that do make a good preservative, but oddly enough, they're not used for that. Someone at one point did a study, and it turns out that oregano, not a spice at all, but oregano is about the best preservatives. Cinnamon isn't too bad, but pepper, chili pepper are next to useless as a preservative.
Let's take some calls. We go now to Lynn from Manhattan. Hi, you're on the air.
Hi. I'm just wondering, does hearing have anything to do with taste? Because it seems like when I eat in a very noisy place, I can't taste my food.
Well, I usually can't hear the person across the table.
That too.
And then I walk out being hoarse. Maybe it has an effect on your vocal cords. What do you think, John?
Well, I think that it's probably, there is a connection between taste and hearing, but I don't think it would play a role in a restaurant. In a restaurant, I think it would more be an attention issue, that you're distracted by all the other environmental cues. You're paying close attention to what the person across the table is saying. There's a lot of background noise. You're distracted, so you're not able to attend. So I think it's more of a psychological phenomena there.
Okay. Well, thank you for calling us. Beth from New Jersey, you're on the air.
Hi. You were talking about hot spices and why the theories behind why we eat those things. And I was wondering if you could comment on the possibility of they have something to do with keeping us well. Because I'd heard from more than one person, like there's this Indian guy talking to me and said, oh, I eat hot foods every day. I never get a cold. I've never gotten one. And I've heard that from more than one person. Is there any?
And that means nobody in India gets a cold, right?
Well, that's a good question. But I mean,
maybe that guy doesn't get colds. I don't get colds either, and I don't always eat hot foods. But what do you think, John, Michael?
I think there probably are some. We're still just scratching the surface because, of course, there are so many different spices we could ask the questions about. With respect to chilies per se, I don't know that there's a lot of evidence with upper respiratory infections. We are just starting to learn that there might be some nutritional benefits in terms of things like blunting the insulin response that you have after a meal, and maybe some of these people might have some better cardiovascular profiles as a result, but that's very preliminary data. So don't go out and say that you heard to take 2 tablespoons of hot sauce a day to avoid the cardiologist.
And chili peppers have been used for all sorts of other medical purposes. They're used in arthritis cream, for example. But my favorite is that they're actually used as weapons, of course. Mace, the stuff you spray, is made out of capsaicin, which is extracted from chilies. And some of the hottest chilies have been developed by the Indian Army, apparently.
Hmm.
If you go
to be used in Kashmir against the Pakistanis?
Using Kashmir chilies, probably, yeah.
Well, I tasted a Kashmir chili, which was really hot. In fact, I tasted all the chilies that were put in front of me. And that was a while ago, and I'm still tasting them. And at a certain point, I'm wondering whether I want to taste them much anymore. And a listener asks if the sensation of the spice, not the taste on the tongue, is actually pain.
John?
It is. But
so I'm experiencing pain right now?
But I would say that pain is defined by context. And we know that from Beecher's famous studies looking at the psychology of troops that were wounded and literally had limbs removed during World War II, that, of course, the context is so dependent on how you interpret the pain. So we've actually learned to like the pain when it comes to spicy food, at least those of us that are self-professed chili heads that, you know, have to have more and more of it. And that's really fascinating, too, because you cannot convince any animal out there to acquire a liking for chili burn. It's only humans and some primates, maybe, that you can actually convince to like it. So that implies that maybe there's this higher level cognitive discontinuity, thrill-seeking thing that we were talking about before.
And not all humans, because as a listener points out, kids often like their food as bland as possible. Is this something that we develop a taste for as we get older, or is it culture-related?
Well, Michael, I don't know if you want to say something more about this, but absolutely in Mexico, in rural Mexico, there's some interesting patterns that emerge that up until about, I think it's age 3 or 4, the food isn't heavily spiced. And then the children are slowly introduced to it through these things that are actually kind of like a pixie stick, but instead of a fruit flavor and sugar, it's actually salt and chili powder.
Well, certainly in India, there's food for children and there's food for adults. And often men get spicier food than women because men supposedly need the more, I guess, virile aspect of
this. Well, there's the macho side of it. I've had a dinner at a Thai restaurant in Asia where the men started demanding a dish called Evil Jungle Priest, which was a chicken dish with so much chili in it that it was scary. And they were kind of daring each other to eat more and more and more. At a certain point, I think they ate so much rice to mitigate the pain that it didn't matter anyway. But it was a macho thing.
Yeah, I've also talked to people in the Yucatan, Mexicans in the Yucatan, who talk about Texans coming down, and in Yucatan they use a lot of habanero chilies, which are one of the hottest chilies around. And there they put the chili into a little bit of sour orange juice and use the sour orange juice that has soaked, that the chili has soaked in, as a condiment. And these Texans would come down and, of course, munch on these things and would have these outrageous reactions, which, of course, make the locals just giggle.
My guests are Michael Crondall and Dr. John E. Hayes. We're talking about spices on today's Please Explain. I wonder about freshness, because after a while, don't all of these spices lose a certain amount of their power if we don't use up the container pretty quickly?
Basically, the minute you grind something, you should use it up. Ground spices.
But they often sit on the spice rack for years.
Exactly. And you should go through your spice rack and basically throw anything ground out, unless you've ground it or bought it ground within the last 6 months. Whole spices, on the other hand, can last years. One of the reasons that black pepper became, you know, this black gold that basically transformed the world during the Age of Exploration was it lasts 10 years, 15 years, 20 years. In fact, the whole black pepper that you buy at your supermarket could easily be a dozen years old, and apparently that's okay.
Let's take another call. Susan from Brooklyn, hi, you're on the air.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. In terms of medical benefits from spices, turmeric is being investigated for anti-cancer properties. So
yeah,
some of these things may have even more important issues that they will deal with.
Do you know about that, John?
I wasn't aware of that particular work, but as I said, and as Michael has said, there are so many different spices that have so many different properties. To try and systematically study them all is just going to take years and years of work.
There has been a lot of study done on turmeric, and it seems if the animal studies are any indication, it will be the wonder drug. But so far, they haven't advanced past animal studies. But apparently, breast cancer in rats has been cured by turmeric.
Lower incidence of certain kinds of cancers in India, where turmeric is a major part of the diet. I've heard that as well. Are there certain regions of the tongue that are especially sensitive to spice? One of our listeners asks.
Well, that brings up just a small bit of a side point. The taste map that we were all taught at some point is completely and utterly wrong. It was never correct, so it's not scientists thought one thing. The very short version is it was all due to some sloppy work by a psychologist at Harvard, and everyone went to him instead of the original source and thought it was definitive and misinterpreted it. So now we have 80 years worth of textbooks that are for children and even college students that are flat out wrong. As far as spice sensitivity, separate from the sweet, sour, salty, bitter, savory question, I don't know that anyone's looked at it in quite the same respect. Actually, I did some work a few years back where we looked and we found that for some people that capsaicin and piperine, which are from chili and black pepper respectively, are actually bitter to some people on the back of the tongue but not the front of the tongue. So in addition to the burn, they cause some bitterness. But as far as actual burn differences on different parts of the tongue, I'm not really aware of a whole lot of evidence for that.
A listener asks, I did start off with this question, but I guess we didn't answer it to anyone's satisfaction. What's the difference between a spice and an herb?
A spice is an aromatic part of a plant. It could be a seed. It could be a root. It could be, in the case of cinnamon, bark, or even a fruit, as in the case of chili peppers. An herb is a leafy aromatic part of a plant. So that oregano, what have you. Now, in certain cases, like in the case of coriander, you can have coriander, the herb, which is cilantro, mm-hmm. by another name. You can also have coriander, the seed, same plant, but now it is a spice.
And what is something like vanilla? Is that
vanilla is considered a spice.
It is a spice.
It is considered a spice.
Even though it's really an essence?
Yeah. It's one of those things where there's a fine line, but most people consider it a spice.
Another person asks whether the hot peppers aren't really stimulating our endorphins, which would be a positive thing.
Well, that seems to be one of the theories, that you get the equivalent of a runner's high when you eat chilies.
The both of you cook. Michael, yep. You're a professional teacher of cooking. What's your advice to people who want to use more spices in their cooking?
First, buy them fresh. Toast them, if possible, in many cases. Toasted cumin tastes so much better than cumin that's just straight out of the jar. Experiment with one or two at a time, and then figure out what the essential flavor of the spice is. Some spices are sweet, like cinnamon. Others are very, very savory, like cumin or caraway. And often in cuisines where they combine the two different kinds of spices, or many different kinds of spices, they will combine one that's sweet, they will combine one that's savory, they will combine one that's mild, and they will combine one that's hot.
You have anything you want to add to that, John?
John? You know, no, I think I'll defer to Michael on that.
But I'm sure because you study this, you think a lot about cooking with spices.
I do. So I would say the number one thing that I use in my house is I go through lots and lots of hot sauce. I keep a couple different kinds around. Some milder ones and some hotter ones, and use them as needed for the dish. And I found now with young children in the house, I can't cook with them in the food, so now it's more important for me to be able to cook the food and then kick it up a little bit in my own dish.
Another listener is concerned about spices in the supermarkets being radiated while the organic ones are not. Does it have an effect?
Michael, do you want to say something about that?
I'm really not qualified to speak to those health issues.
I actually think irradiated spices are an excellent idea for the reason that because so many spices are very heat sensitive, we can't thermally treat them the way we would other things. And by irradiating, we can kill certain spore-forming microorganisms that can cause pretty nasty foodborne illness. And so I think using irradiated spices is totally appropriate.
We have a caller who knows something about Indian foods, Samreg from West Harrison. Hi, you're on the air.
Hey, I'm actually an Indian. I was born and brought up in Dubai, so I know a little bit about Arabic and Indian food, eating them, not cooking them. When I was growing up, I preferred blander food and less spicier, but watching friends have chilies like they were a side dish, I ended up having to eat them a lot just because people will keep saying, oh, you don't like your food spicy. And that was basically it. And it was something that was incultured into me. And on top of that, I think Indian food has a philosophy that says every bite should be an explosion of flavor rather than the more European system where it's like you should be able to taste the herb that the cook says is in it. And that's my two cents on difference between Indian and other styles of cooking.
Well, yeah. I think that
go ahead.
This comes back to what we were talking about with cultural differences. But I know that I don't remember the exact proportion, but again, Rosin's work in rural Mexico showed that most Americans that like spicy food just really like spicy food. But in Mexico, there is a large machismo component, and that some large proportion of the men don't actually like the spicy food, but they eat it because of these cultural overlays.
And then there's England, where the English tend to eat the hottest Indian food, hotter than the Indians want to eat it, even though English food on the whole is rather bland. Who can explain these things? But I want to thank the two of you so much for being with us on today's Please Explain. My guests, Dr. Johnny Hayes, assistant professor of food science at Penn State University, who studies the psychophysics of taste and flavor perception, and Michael Crundell, who is a chef, teacher, and author of several books about food and cooking, including Around the American Table and The Taste of Conquest, The Rise and Fall of Three Great Cities of Spice, which is published by Ballantine. It's been a real pleasure.
Thank you, Leonard.
Thank you very much.
On Monday's show, Time Magazine business correspondent Michael Schumann discusses the dynamic transformation of Asian economies into miracle powerhouses of growth. And then the latest in our underappreciated summer reading series. Also, David Masamuto, an organic peach farmer, on what he learned about growing things from his father. Plus a panel discussion that includes Daniel Ballou on how restaurateurs are adapting to the recession. The Leonard Lopate Show is produced by Blakeney Schick, Stephen Valentino, and Julia Corcoran. Melissa Egan is the executive producer, and we had help today from Sherry Shen, Nicole Silbersack, and contributing producer Bonnie Lefebvre. Debbie Fountain was at the audio controls. I'm Leonard Lopate, your host. Thanks for listening. We'll see you next week.